Well, good morning, church. Is it just me? Is anybody else a little tired? Yes. It's not the person I expected to get the amen from there, but yeah, it was a big day yesterday. If you were there, and so many of you were there, by the way, it was so good to see you and see folks. Some of you, I enjoyed talking to folks who this was their first experience of One Day of Hope. And it was just neat to see them kind of processing how big and how much was going on. Now, this is the numbers I got, and I'm not sure how official it was, but the numbers I got that we had somewhere around 376 volunteers. 376 people who worked just yesterday, and that the number of families that came through, or the number of people who came through, was 1,805. So that's, in a town the size of Manchester, that's a lot of folks. It's a whole lot of folks. In fact, I just give us a little applause here for all the people who worked so hard to make that happen. And somebody asked me about it, and they were asking, when did we do it all? And I was like, I don't know. I said, really and truly, I know that they start working on it, I mean, months in advance, and then they're working on just getting the supplies for different things, whether it's food or toiletries or clothes or shoes, or they do that in months in advance all the way up until, really days ahead of time. And I said, we take over the fairgrounds about a week to get this all accomplished. They were just amazed. Someone who'd never been there before. It is an amazing, amazing thing. I just really am thankful for all of the hard work and dedication and leadership and sacrifice that goes into making One Day such a special part of our congregation's lives. Now, I don't know about you, but to me, One Day is almost like an anomaly. It's what makes it special is that it's not like anything else. Like this is not the way the world normally operates, right? Normally, this is not the way things function. And so as I watch my kids are grown up. I've got them both out of town today. One of them across, just an hour or so away. One of them way far away. But just having them that far away, I think about what kind of world are we leaving to the next generation. I think back, I'm now, nearly 30 years old, and I look back in my lifetime about how much the world has changed in just my lifetime. And I think, how much is the world going to change in another 30 years? Right? How much is this world going to look, or 50 years, if I could imagine that far? Or what kind of challenges and obstacles are going to exist that we can't even imagine yet, right? What kind of mess are we going to leave them behind that we don't even know we're leaving behind? What kind of claims will their culture make on them? Like, our culture makes claims on us that our parents certainly never imagined when they were our age. So what kind of claims will their culture make on them? And I have to confess that one of my concerns increasingly is going to be claims on their allegiance. And there's going to be a lot of battles on this front. I specifically think about the claims between church and state. The claims between church and state. Now, from the very beginnings of Christianity, and even in the years leading up to Jesus' arrival, this had been a hot button issue in the people of God. Like, what do I owe to who, right? Who gets to claim my allegiance? And one of the passages that we turn to when we're thinking about this question comes from the Gospel of Mark. Comes from the very passage we're going to be looking at this morning. And it's one of the controversy stories that we find here at the end of Mark's gospel, near the end of Jesus' earthly ministry. And at its heart, there's a quote that you're going to recognize probably. It's been cited numerous times, both in support of and against the same arguments. But when we dig a little deeper, when we kind of get in behind the scenes, I think we're going to see there's a lot more going on here than we get out of a surface quote. So my prayer, my request is that we kind of look at that guiding principle that Jesus is laying down so that we can make the best decisions for our lives in this arena. It starts in Mark chapter 12, beginning at verse 13. Later, and remember this whole scenario, Jesus is in Jerusalem. It's for this big feast day. There's been a lot of controversy. It's when he overthrew tables in the temple. The authorities come and question his authority to do that. And then he tells this parable that really gets under their skin. And so now they're like, this guy has got to go. So this is the plan. This is how they want to achieve getting rid of Jesus. They sent, like not just they went. This is an emissary. These are some people who are on a mission. They sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to catch Jesus, to catch him in his words. And they came to him and they said, "Teacher, we know you are a man of integrity." Oh, just watch out. Anybody starts a sentence like that, you're in trouble. "Teacher, we know you're a man of integrity. You aren't swayed by others because you pay no attention to who they are, but you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. So, since all those things are true, is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar or not? Should we pay it or shouldn't we?" Now, let's just pause right here because we need to understand some things about what's going on right here. There's a lot of subtext in this text. So at the time of Jesus, the Jews in Judea was a province. It wasn't all of what we think of Israel. It was the province that included the city of Jerusalem. Just that immediate area. And the Jews who lived in that immediate area of had to pay a few different kinds of taxes. They had to pay land taxes, right? You own this much land. You pay taxes on your personal property. Not only do you have this land, but you also have personal property tax. And there were these imperial taxes like customs. And it was a pretty heavy tax burden. In other words, if you lived in the province of Judea, you had a heavy tax burden. But that's not the issue here. This issue, the burning question of the day was, is it right for God's people to pay a tribute to Caesar? That's the question. Is it right for God's people to pay a tribute to Caesar? Now, all Roman taxes, and this ought to resonate with you today, right? All Roman taxes, customs, tolls, every bit of it, they were all unpopular. But this tax, it's sometimes translated the imperial tax, sometimes known as a tribute or a poll tax, this one was particularly offensive. Now, this is a new tax. It was imposed just a few years earlier, just a generation earlier, in AD 6. So around when Jesus was, 6 years old, if we can go by the calendar. It was when he was a little kid. They imposed this for the first time when they did a census. And it was just after Judea had been named an official Roman province. And when they did that, they named Judea a Roman province. They added this tax to them, and it led to an immediate revolt. There was a guy named Judas, no relation to the one you're thinking of, a guy named Judas who was from Galilee. Yes, the Galilee you're thinking of. And this man named Judas led a revolt, like a bloody, let's fight them out revolt. And now Rome, being Rome, they brought down the hammer on those guys pretty darn quick. In fact, they crucified those rebels not far from where Jesus grew up. So when Jesus was a little boy, six-ish years old, he might have well seen what happens to rebels when they rise up against Rome, crucified along the roadside, right? But this revolt, even though it was unsuccessful, it continued to inspire. Like, people were like, those guys were patriots. We should stand up like they stood up. And so this revolt is what inspired the movement that came to be known as the Zealot movement. You may remember that one of Jesus' apostles, Simon, was a zealot. And they were like guerrilla fighters. Not guerrilla fighters, because those guys would lose for sure. But they were fighting using guerrilla tactics, right? They would just do whatever they could to get rid of Rome. And they were inspired by these rebels back here because of this tax. So the zealots eventually got their stuff together enough that in AD 66, so after Jesus has died, all this has happened, AD 66, they led a big revolt in Jerusalem, and it was bloody. And it made Rome so mad that they said no more of this. And in AD 70, they come through and they annihilate the city. They destroy the temple. They kill everybody they want to kill. They take it, whatever it is they want to take. And Jerusalem is no more. That happens just all because all of that can be traced back to this one tax. So if you're saying this is a controversial question, that's an understatement. It would be like saying a question about slavery was controversial just before the Civil War. Right? This is not just a controversial question. It's not even just a political question. This is a theological question. It has to do with what you believe about God. Can God's people pay this tax to Caesar? Jesus himself had said, no man can serve two masters. So if I'm paying a tax to this Caesar, am I serving two masters? Am I trying to serve both God and Rome? So could someone be loyal to both God and Rome? And here come these religious leaders. They're like, we have got the question. We're going to get him now. And so these leaders come to Jesus and they're like, they're giving him the flattery. You're a man of integrity and you teach the way of God, the truth, which is all true. Everything they're saying is true, but they don't mean it, right? And they're like, but since you're so great, what do you think? And either way, Jesus answers this question, yes or no, they've got him. If he says, yes, it's right to pay it, then the people will hate him because it sounds like he's not being loyal to God. If he says, no, it's not right to pay it, then the leaders can accuse Jesus of inciting rebellion or trying to start a riot, right? But Jesus sees this question for what it actually is. This question is not a question, it's a trap. And he sees those men who are asking it for who they are. They are not religious leaders. They're hypocrites. So this is what he says. Oh, this is, by the way, this is the famous picture of the fall of Rome. It was, photo quality wasn't as good as we have today, but it happened. All right, the fall of Jerusalem. So Jesus knew their hypocrisy. He knows what's going on here. Why are you trying to trap me? He asked. Bring me a denarius, right? This is a Roman coin, about a day's pay. Bring me a denarius and let me look at it. So they brought the coin, and he asked them, whose image is this and whose inscription? Caesar's, they replied. Then Jesus said to them, give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And they were amazed at him. Now, it's interesting. We've gone through Mark's gospel here together. You may not have been here every week, but we've gone through it all together. And Jesus, when he's asked a question by these guys who are trying to trap him, trying to trick him, trying to find something wrong with him, Jesus never answers their questions the way they want him to answer their questions. Jesus always answers their question with another question. So Jesus, rather than answering them, he says, bring me a coin. Bring me one of these coins. And this was the coin. This was a Roman denarius about the time of Jesus. It was the sort of coin you had to pay your tribute with. It was a Roman denarius. It was silver. It was a coin that's minted in Rome and then distributed to all of their provinces. And then it has an image and it has an inscription of the emperor on it. Now, the image of the current emperor and the inscription would have said, Divi aug filius, which I don't speak Latin, so let's just go with that. And what that means is son of the divine Augustus, or Augustus. This was, the inscription would have been on the Roman coin. So this is not just politically offensive, it's sacrilegious. You see the point here? No man should be called divine. Certainly not a heathen pagan like this Roman emperor. Nobody should be called divine. So everyday Jewish people in the province of Judea would not use this coin. Now, Rome wouldn't let them print their own money, except they could print little copper coins. Rome didn't care about that. But they didn't want them printing big money. If you start printing big money, you can make big moves. So they let them print their own little copper coins. And everyday, ordinary Jewish people, in the course of their day, they would be able to use their little copper coins. That's how they would buy things. That's how they would pay for things. That's how they would do their transactions, because they did not want to carry this coin. This coin is sacrilegious. So when Jesus says, hey, does anyone have one? His questioners, the guys who are trying to put him on the spot, reach into their pockets and pull out this coin. It shows that they are hypocrites. You're not really concerned about this coin if you're carrying it around. Does that make sense? You don't really care how Jesus answers this question if you're already carrying this coin around. So Jesus makes his questioners produce this coin, and he is exposing their hypocrisy. Then Jesus says, when they bring it out, he says, give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and give to God the things that are God's. Now, some people have used this quote, and talked about it just a little bit earlier, some people have used this quote to say Jesus is talking about two kingdoms, right? Church and state. Give to the state the things that are state, give to the church the things that are church. Y'all may not be going anywhere for a long time. I don't know if you know what's going on outside, but it was a hurricane. Anyway, some people see this quote right up here, and they think that Jesus is authorizing a two-state solution, so to speak, right? He's authorizing two kingdoms. But to look at this quote and think Jesus is talking about two kingdoms is to miss the point entirely. Yes, it is a really clever response. Yes, it pointed out the hypocrisy of his questioners. And so it was an amazing answer. People heard the answer and they were amazed at Jesus. But more than getting Jesus out of a tight spot, this answer reveals what God is really after. This answer tells you what God is really after. You and I, we carry money. I even have a little bit. I mean, I don't want to make y'all jealous, but I've got a quarter myself, and so I'm feeling pretty good about myself. This quarter, or whatever American currency, or whatever currency you have to have in your pocket this morning, this is a coin, and you know who it belongs to? Well, it's mine. It's in my pocket, but no, if you look on the back, it tells you who it belongs to. It says right on there that it's the United States of America. So I can use this coin or bill or whatever you've got. You can use it. You can say it belongs to you, but there's some things that you're not allowed to do with it because it's not really yours. So I couldn't, for instance, get a stack of $20 bills and set it on fire. Not legally. I can't take all my quarters and melt them down and use them for the metal, right? Because they're not really mine. I'm allowed to use it. But there's a claim on there. I couldn't afford to burn the 20s anyway, but I might could melt down the quarters. But imagine in Jesus' day, they knew what this said. This is just theirs to use. So this quarter in this case has an image on it. The image on this one is George Washington. And it has the claim of the government on there, United States of America. This belongs to them. It is theirs. You can tell because it tells you right there who this belongs to. You can use it, but if they ask for it, you got to give it. You may not like it. I may not like it. You may not think it's right. You may not think it's fair. And I might even agree with you. But it's theirs. So if they ask for it, you give it to them. So if that's the case, if it's theirs because it has their image on it, what is God's image on? What belongs to God? What has the claim of God upon it? He says, give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Give to God the things that are God's. Well, what is God? Well, we're told all the way back in the very beginning of the Bible, the very first chapter of Genesis, God says, let us make man in our image. So where is God's image? It's sitting to your left, sitting to your right, and staring you right in the face when you look in the mirror. That's where God's image is. And if you're supposed to give to God the things that are God's, that means you, and it means me. It means your life. It means your being. It all has God's image stamped right upon it. And let me be honest, church. Sometimes I think we get really tempted to be like those religious leaders. What I mean by that is we get so fixated on what does and doesn't belong to the government, the business, whoever. We get so fixated on what does and doesn't belong to the kingdoms of this world that we forget what belongs to God. That's what those religious leaders have done. They're so worried about what's theirs and what's the government, they forget about what is God's. We get so focused on what is ours that we ignore what is His. We get so tuned in to our rights that we completely are oblivious to God's claim upon us. Because we are living in a world that tells you it is all about you, it's all about what you own, all about what you have, all about your rights. That's what the world tells you. And Jesus is telling you, give to God the things that are God's. You have to understand that you bear the image of the Creator of the universe. It is stamped on your inner being. And no matter how good you are, no matter how bad you are, and no matter what church you come from, and no matter what church you're going to, and no matter how hard you're trying or how hard you're not trying, or how successful or how unsuccessful, no matter the color of your skin or your age or your race or your sex or what you've gotten yourself into, you bear the image of God. And you are always going to bear the image of God. You can't cover it up. You can't hide it. You can try to ignore it, but it's still going to be there. But you still belong to God. And so God has this claim upon you, has this claim upon your life. You have been claimed by God. You have been bought at a great price. You have been brought into a family that you didn't start to be a part of a generation of believers, a generation of brothers and sisters. Can I get an amen? That is what God has done for you. That is the claim He has placed upon you. Give to God the things that are God's. I've got two actual bills in my wallet. But all this right here, that is worthless. That doesn't get you into God's family. All of these great things that we have and the cars that you drive and the things you may accomplish in this life, that is worthless. That does not get you in and out of the family of God. That does not put His image on you or take His image away from you. What God has done is what does that. And He has brought you in and made you His. So give to God the things that are God's. Let's stop being so focused on what the world wants and what the world has a right to. And let's be focused on what God has a claim to. You and yours. And if we can pray for you, encourage you, lift you up this morning, we want to do that. If you're ready to become a child of God, to take your life as weak or meager or broken or whatever it is your life may be right now, if you're ready to give that life to God and say, God, whatever you want to do with it, it's yours. We want to help you by having your sins washed away, putting on the body of Christ. So won't you come now if you stand as we sing.